So we're speaking with Jonathan Feiberg. The book is Modern Art at the Border of Mind and Brain. You're a visiting distinguished professor at University of California, Irvine, and the Edward William and Jane Marge Gutsill Professor Emeritus at the University of Illinois. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, it's great to be talking to you.
And it's interesting, you know, you write about the mind and the image and everything else, and you talk about abstract images. But the fact is, for me today, I was reading your book, and you have this thing, perceptions diverge, and then you formulate this interpretations of, and then the image becomes increasingly individualized. So let's get into that, the image. How does our mind kind of work with it?
Well, you know, seeing is a kind of an evolutionary requirement for us. You know, if you don't see what's in front of you, you're going to get eaten by a predator. So our brain is wired to see, but what we actually see is not simply physically what's in front of us. That's probably less than 20% comes from the eye. Most of what we see comes from what we call intrinsic processing, which is memory and established circuitry in the brain and emotional systems and reason and all kinds of other things that get pulled together and processed at the back of the head in the so-called visual processing areas. So seeing is a very creative act that requires us to put all the pieces of information together to see what's in front of us, and it requires us to constantly revise and test those things. And the whole argument of this book is about why it is that we're still making images after 30,000 years. After all, we only have written language for a tenth that amount of time, and we're still doing it, I think, because we need images to complete the wiring of the brain. And it's an evolutionary argument, and it's not an argument that I ever heard growing up. I mean, everybody would say to me, oh, art's really important, and then it would get shoved to the side because nobody gave you a scientific reason for why. I think we can explain why, and that's kind of what I'm trying to do.
Talking about how powerful the image is, and again, individualizing it, this morning, you know, we have all these immigration problems in Europe, and I saw the young boy who had passed away, and now if you had just reported it or written about it, I don't know that I would have had the emotional connection. But seeing a three-year-old boy, here, I saw it, and then I process it as though he looks a lot like my son. And obviously, the idea of the picture being worth a thousand words, the oldest analogy, here you have this thing that's now going to be stuck with me for days, weeks, and months, because of the image, not because of the words or text. You know, how does that work with our mind? I mean, you write so poetically about the book, but how does that resonate? Like, how is this going to be stuck with me for maybe even years, that image, or an image of the monks in Vietnam burning themselves, you know, which can turn the tide of a whole war?
Well, I mean, absolutely. Images are so powerful. Look at the effect of the Vietnam War going on to television for the first time and, you know, changing America. And the civil rights movement is the same way. All of a sudden, we saw these images in our living room, and we never forgot them. So you're absolutely right. Those images are indelible. They stay with us. They really change the way we think about things. And great works of art also change the way we think about things, and they also change our ability to adapt to what we see. So this is all a very important part of how the brain works. I completely agree with you. I saw that picture myself this morning in the newspaper and thought, oh my God, this child, you know, in the guy's arms coming out of the water, a dead child. And, you know, so many things are brought to the fore in your brain besides just the visual image. It's all the associations that connect to that, other things that you knew before about what that image means. So much is brought into play, and of course it has a very strong effect on all the ways in which those kinds of bits of information in your brain are connected. It rewires it in a sense.
I once had an art professor who was also an artist, and she said, you know, when she sees an image she likes, a painting she likes, or a video she likes, she gives it a minor amount of thought. And if she sees something she hates, it's very interesting that then she would focus on, why do I hate it, and then would go further into it. So this thing, is that, and you write about artists who do push the buttons. The artist is escaping me, but, you know, the one that uses a lot of religious iconography. Why is it something that once we hate something, we focus on it more? And that could work in other fields, but in art, why is that? Why do you think our mind works that way? That something where controversy and things that disturb us may make us focus on it more.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up. I mean, I think you're talking about David Wojnarowicz,
yes,
who is a very controversial, difficult artist. Was a gay activist, one of the real founders of ACT UP when the HIV crisis just began. And I have to tell you, when I first looked at David Wondorovich's work, I didn't like it either. In fact, I had a really visceral negative reaction to it, but I've been in this business long enough to know that when I react to something like that, there's something important about it that I need to come to terms with, and I often end up really falling in love with those works, as I did with his works. In fact, I became a friend of his ultimately because I was so interested in what he did. I think the core to this is that when you see something that's so powerful that it really upsets you and kind of throws everything out of kilter for you, your first reaction is a defensive one. You know, I don't want anything to do with this. And the second reaction is, wow, there's something I didn't see before. And, you know, you know, when you fall in love with somebody, you allow somebody into your emotional space, and it's a very disorganizing experience because all the patterns of your life get disturbed in some way. But because of the power of your affection for that person, you allow them to enter that space, and in a sense, you have to reorganize yourself in relation to that relationship. I think that's what happens with a great work of art. You know, if it really touches you deeply, it may be very upsetting and disorganizing and uncomfortable at first, but it also may be something that takes you to another level in terms of your adaptability, your creativity, your sense of who you are in the world. It's a very kind of enriching experience, and ultimately you will fall in love with that work for that very reason.
And what's interesting, you know, clearly you have famous works that you could say, well, that's amazing. But what's interesting about art that I find is that you can have an image that many people might, you know, again, we're talking about hate. But, you know, if it works to you, then it really is a great work of art for you, right? I mean, how do we determine what, like, is a great work of art? Or is it something where a lot of minds converge and say, this is one, you know?
I think it has to speak to a larger audience. You know, an audience of one probably isn't enough for us to call it a great work of art. But, you know, I think about I mentioned this in the beginning of the book, the Freud's essay on the Moses of Michelangelo, which he wrote in 1913. He would not sign that essay for another 10 years. He published it anonymously in American Imago. And what he said about it is, he said, when we look at these things, we know great works of art have a big impact on us, and I'm going to quote from Freud, he says, we are unable to say what they represent to us. And he talks about bewilderment. He says, you know, for something to be a great work of art, you have to be kind of bewildered and unable to deal with this disturbing content in it. And what he says about it is, well, you know, music does that to me, and I don't like music for that reason. If I can't explain why something has its effect on me, I don't want anything to do with it. So he sort of writes it off, but at the same time, he acknowledges what's really important and how it does work on him. Freud had his own problems, and that was a manifestation of them. But I think we've all understood this about works of art, that there's something deep about them. They really move you. They can be very disturbing. And I think they have an effect on a lot of people if we only allow ourselves to go there.
I want to let the listeners know we're speaking with Jonathan Weinberg, a visiting distinguished professor at University of California, Irvine. The book he has written is Modern Art at the Border of Mind and Brain. There's so many things, you know, you can go with this. What do you think is the new iconography? I mean, you're talking about 30,000 years of images. They're not going anywhere. You have photography. What's the next stage for art, you know, with the image? And how will technology impact that?
Well, you know, I learned a lot looking at children's drawings. I've written several books about children's drawings, and what I realized about children is that children are always trying to make all the things that they see in the world cohere into some kind of worldview. I think what great artists do is the same thing on a more sophisticated level. So, you know, we don't know anything about the future except that it won't be like the present, and we're constantly being bombarded by new information, new circumstances, new realities, and we are constantly trying to adapt to that, to try and to see what it is and how we need to react to that. And works of art, I think, help us visualize things and think about things before we even have words to describe them and to articulate the relations between the parts. That's one of the things that art gives us.
Well, it's interesting about that, about, you know, and about political art. You write about that too. So you have this Alexander Calder's piece, Mercury Fountain, which compared to Guernica, and we can get into that too, Picasso's Guernica in the Spanish Republican Pavilion. Can you explain to our listeners what there's this difference? Because here's this thing that is very political, and Guernica, for most people who know, because again, that has a massive effect, is this very, you know, dire and dark image, and it's very powerful. The other one is also powerful, equally powerful, but it's not as, you know, a dire and dark.
Well, in the end, it is as dire and dark. It's just that nobody quite recognizes that at first. You know, Calder is filled with humor, and he does things in a way that's so, it's seemingly so simple, yeah, because the way he constructs an image, you know, the Mercury Fountain that was done for the Spanish Republican Pavilion at that time in 1937, you know, was made with just twisting wire. He made a little mobile, but there was a fountain of mercury. And when you begin to look closely at that, that mercury is very disturbing. It has the viscosity of blood, and it's heavy. So it's not exactly playful anymore. And as you get more into the materials begin to speak to you on a level that's beyond simply what you can describe in words. So in the end, that, as I said in this, in a more detailed way in the book, that work, you know, is deeply political, and it's also fundamentally very disturbing, just as disturbing as the Guernica is. And it's eccentric for Calder's work because it's so directly disturbing, and that's not usual for him. He's a guy who likes to just, you know, not address that kind of material quite so directly, even though his work is very profound.
You have such a long history of fine art and art being done on canvas and on walls and everything else. With new technology, with everything else, I mean, is representing form more important than, say, abstract? Is abstract still equally important to our mind? Because it's something we need that we can understand, but then we have to think about. And, you know, everyone tells you, well, painting's dead. This thing's dead. This art form is dead. What is technology doing to art? We've talked about that a little bit. And the idea of abstract versus representing form, and how does that work with our mind, with seeing, say, an image of like a photograph versus an abstract piece of art?
You know, all art is abstract. You know, an image which you recognize as correlated to something you've seen before is also flat. You know, so it's all abstract. The question is how abstract and what the conventions are that we're used to seeing about it. So, you know, I just had just the night before last, I was talking to Christo, who's one of the artists I write about in the book, about his new project. And, you know, all of his, he's doing a new project in Italy this coming June, but every project that he's done, the biggest objection to his projects, interestingly enough, and the thing for which people get so passionate they burst into tears at public hearings, is they say it's not art. And if you stop and think about that, why would that matter to anybody?
Yeah.
And you realize that what's really at stake is not that it's not art, but the fact that they think it's not art means that they can't control it. It's a little bit out of control. It's something that we can't quite categorize, and that's something we want to do all the time, is to fit things into a system that we have an understanding of and have agency over. And works of art don't quite let you do that. And that's their great value, but it's also a little scary when they really affect you in that way. It can be a little bit disorienting. And I think Christo's a great example. He's a guy who never fit the norms. You know, I don't think the public has, and certainly the art world, have not come to terms with his importance yet, because he didn't have a dealer. He doesn't make a work that you can sell. He destroys the work after 10 days, so you see it and you remember it, and there are books about it, but the work itself is gone. So he doesn't make any money off of them either. So all of that, you know, goes against all the rules. Nobody can quite figure out how to categorize this or how to put it in a box. And we're always looking to kind of put dangerous things in a box.
Yeah, we definitely are. The book is Modern Art at the Border of Mind and Brain. We were speaking with Professor Jonathan Feinberg, visiting distinguished professor at University of California, Irvine, among a huge array of resumes. Thank you so much for joining us, Professor Feinberg.
Well, thanks for asking me.